Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Violence in the Middle East has become a way of life. That doesn't make it less upsetting or easier to understand, but it does help explain how life and business there go on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Monday. It is the 29th of December today. Airstrikes continued in the Gaza Strip all day today. So far, at least 335 people have been killed by the Israeli raids. Palestinians are still firing rockets into southern Israel, too. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak said today a ceasefire with Hamas is out of the question. Shops and banks are closed in the Gaza Strip. Electricity is being rationed to about 8 hours every single day. But Daniel Estrin reports the attacks haven't completely put a damper on commerce.
Over the weekend, Israeli warplanes bombed 40 underground tunnels on the border between Egypt and Gaza. Israel says those tunnels are used to smuggle in weapons, missiles, and even foreign fighters. But the tunnel industry has also dominated Gaza commerce. Israel's sanctions on Gaza restrict certain consumer goods, so smugglers squeeze through everything from refrigerators to Viagra. There are about 800 tunnels altogether. And Omer Sha'aban, a Gaza-based economist, says some smugglers are making good money off of the crisis.
The people who are managing or owning these tunnels will use this opportunity to raise prices, and they'll profit from it, because working the tunnels during an Israeli military operation becomes more risky.
And people are depending on them to take that risk. After all, Sha'aban says, about 90% of all the goods in the Gaza Strip come through these tunnels. From Jerusalem, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
The lead business story also comes out of the Middle East via that plastic shampoo bottle or the grocery bag you might have used today. Dow Chemical probably had something to do with making either one of them. And if all had gone as planned, by the new year, a state-owned Kuwaiti company would have been making those products with Dow. The two companies had agreed on a joint venture worth billions of dollars. Kuwait, though, pulled out late Sunday. Now another Dow deal is at risk of crumbling, in part because the company's shares dropped almost 20% today. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Kuwait's turnaround is a big blow to Dow Chemical's business strategy. It won't have access to Kuwait's cheap raw materials or cutting-edge technology, and it won't have the cash from the joint venture. It was money Dow needed to finance the acquisition of its rival Rohm & Haas. Ben Johnson's an analyst with Morningstar.
They were going to diversify into higher-end specialty chemicals by acquiring Rohm & Haas while simultaneously shedding some of its more basic, lower-margin commodity businesses.
Dow Chemical inked the Rohm & Haas deal in July, but it had to pay a premium price, $78 a share in an all-cash deal, to get it. Now that Kuwait said never mind, analysts worry that Dow Chemical can't afford Rohm & Haas. Frank Mitch is with BB&T Capital Markets in New York.
We think going through with the transaction as it's currently situated puts the company at great peril.
But Dow Chemical might not have much of a choice. If the company reneges on Rohm & Haas, it'll have to pay a $750 million termination fee plus additional breakup costs. And a new deal with Kuwait's unlikely, too. It backed out because of the global financial crisis and falling crude oil prices. Mitch says global innovation may be on hold for now, at least when it comes to products from oil and gas.
The need to be cautious dealing with the totalitarian states that happen to be where a lot of the oil and gas is found makes it very problematic.
In a statement, Dow said it was committed to its Middle East strategy. Rohm & Haas issued a statement saying it has a definitive agreement with Dow Chemical. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Millions of Americans are back home today from their Christmas holidays, maybe trying to set up an electronic gift or two, asking the perennial question, does it take AA batteries or AAA? Or perhaps more appropriately for 2008, how do I plug this guitar into my Wii? The consumer electronics industry is doing a little setting up itself, getting ready for the annual Consumer Electronics Show out in Las Vegas. This year, though, there is a small warning on the box. It says, consumers not included. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports. The Consumer Electronics Show is one of the big, huge trade shows of the year. Jason Oxman with the Consumer Electronics Association describes it as
the place at which every major consumer electronics innovation you can imagine was first unveiled.
The industry includes all the TVs, DVD players, PlayStations, computers, and cell phones out there, and its U.S. revenues are expected to reach $173 billion this year. But the retailers who sell electronics are hurting, so much so that CES attendance will be thousands of people lower than it was last year.
And one thing that we've done this year is assist some of the smaller companies by providing them some travel assistance to help offset the high cost of airfare.
That may not be enough, says Ross Rubin, who covers the industry for the NPD Group. He says while many now see their electronics as a necessity, the industry is not immune to the recession.
If consumers aren't cutting back absolutely on buying the product, they're often cutting back in terms of the price that they're looking to pay or the brand that they're looking to acquire.
That means smaller plasma screens and smaller profits for retailers. Jason Oxman does see one good side to the down economy, at least when it comes to boosting attendance at the CES.
This year, because tourist traffic to Las Vegas has fallen off the cliff, hotels are offering very good rates.
That may be one reason many companies are moving their product displays into hotel suites and off of the pricey showroom floor. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders seem to have run right out of holiday spirit. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It was tough to turn away earlier this year as the stock market went into its spiral. In part, it was a watching a train wreck kind of thing, because one hopes, anyway, that 777-point single-day losses on the Dow aren't going to come around too often. But it was an equally intensely personal thing for a lot of us, because as the Dow and the S&P dropped, so did our retirement savings, our college funds, and a lot of other investments that we use to measure personal wealth. We turned to Robert Reich, a regular commentator for this program, as you know, to talk more about those losses and how we're dealing with them.
Incomes are dropping, partly because people are losing jobs or they are losing hours on the job. That means that we are seeing median incomes continue to drop. But also we're seeing people who have savings, their nest eggs are dropping or disappearing. People's homes have been their major nest egg. Those homes have dropped in some places around the country 20% in value. The S&P 500 stock index has lost about 36% since January. A lot of 401ks and IRAs depend on that. Well, that means that people have about 30 to 40% less in their mutual funds.
And now, you're a policy guy, right? You're not a straight economist. But I have to ask the question of what does that translate into? That loss of wealth, whether it's perceived, right, because none of us have cashed out our IRAs yet, what does that do to the way we behave?
It means we don't have enough money to buy. Or if we do have a cash flow, a lot of us are far more reluctant to buy anything that's extraneous. But you see, when Americans pull back as they are pulling back from the malls, from spending, that is entirely rational from the standpoint of individual consumers. They ought to do that. They ought to save more. They have to save more. But from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, it is irrational because it means that there are just not enough buyers for all the goods and services that we as an economy are producing, which in turn means more layoffs.
How much ground do you think we've lost? I mean, companies are either not hiring or laying off people. They're cutting wages and benefits. How long is it going to take us to get back to where we were before this whole thing happened?
Well, that's the biggest question, Kai. The consensus, though, seems to be that 2009 is going to be a very bad year, and we're not going to get back on our feet. The economy turned around until, at earliest, 2010. The problem here, Kai, is that nobody knows where the bottom is, and that itself generates a great deal of fear.
But the point is, we've lost so much ground, even after a recovery in late 2009, if we're lucky, it's going to take us some time to get back to what we're used to having, right?
Well, if you're talking about used to in terms of getting the stock market back to where it was in 2004 or 2005? Well, it could take a very long time. If you're talking about getting incomes back to where they were in 2000, which is about the highest they were adjusted for inflation, that could take easily another 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So it will come back. The real question for people is how long and how much pain in the interim.
Grim as all of this is, I need you to help me find some cause for optimism. Other than the fact that the economy will eventually recover, what else is there for us to look forward to?
Well, Kai, first of all, just relatively speaking, the American economy in the late 90s, the early part of this decade, was in wonderful shape, but even before the bubble, people were living okay. The poor were still having a hard time, but America was not a poor place. So even if we go back to the mid-90s in terms of housing values and stock values and a lot of other things, we're not all that bad off.
Robert Reich, he teaches public policy at Berkeley. He writes books, too, the latest one of which is called Super Capitalism. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
It's early yet to know exactly what the collective loss of wealth is going to mean for all of us. But some things are going to have to change, retirements among them. Some people are going to have to stop working later than they'd planned, or perhaps not retire at all. Commentator Tim Evanson says he'd be okay with that.
I'm fairly convinced that retirement is a scant possibility for me, but that's not so bad. At age 28, I am fully prepared to work until my dying day. I can't afford to contribute to a 401k because I don't have any income left over at the end of the month. I have approximately zero in savings, $200,000 in student loan debt. I do believe that Social Security is going to last for a while, but not until I'm 75 or 85 or whatever they change the retirement age to by the middle of the 21st century. Honestly, what I'm hoping for right now, my best case scenario is that I can make a little more down the road, pay off my loans before my kids turn 18 so I can get them through college, and sock enough away to become a part-time counsel somewhere when I'm older. I'm not bitter. Honestly, the concept of retirement seems a little selfish to me. I mean, expecting to retire is a luxury just a few generations old. It's not exactly the entitlement people like to call it. I would happily give it up in exchange for some other benefits. For example, I would love it if the government could somehow fold Social Security money, if there is any, into funding for single-payer health care. I would work until my hands fell off if I knew my son could go to the doctor and we wouldn't have to file for bankruptcy. Plus, if I didn't have to think about affordable health insurance, I'd have more freedom in choosing where to work instead of my plan now, which is to get into the biggest corporate mega firm possible so I can insure my family for under $1,000 a month. I mean, money is meant to be used to make us happy anyway, right? Why would I want to wait until I was in my 70s to be happy? If I ever have enough money to put away, I think I'd put it to use. I would rather feel the pride of watching my kids graduate, knowing they won't be saddled with the debt that I had, or take vacations with my wife and our youth, or actually pay off a mortgage. You know, crazy stuff like that.
Tim Evanson is an attorney in Chicago, Illinois. He writes about labor law when he's not lamenting retirement. Let us know what's on your mind. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Hedge funds were supposed to be the smart money, special investments for rich people who really know how to pick them. But a lot of those funds have lost billions for their investors, everybody from individuals to pension funds to college endowments. Some of them have shut down. Some of them even invested in Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Others, though, are still the smart money, even though there continues to be a lot of mystery about what exactly hedge funds are. So we asked Mitchell Hartman to find out for us earlier this year in the Marketplace Decoder.
First, the textbook answer. A hedge fund is a private partnership that pools money from wealthy individuals, pension funds, corporations, and the like, and invests it to make a profit. Because the fund is private, it doesn't have to report how much it earns or what it's holding to financial regulators. Will Swartz of SmartMoney.com has been following the hedge fund industry for over a decade. He says it used to be pretty simple to define a hedge fund.
It was a fund that held some stocks long, where you'd make money if they'd go up, and some stocks short, where you would make money if they went down.
By betting both sides of the market, the fund balanced out or hedged its risk. These days, hedge funds invest in all sorts of markets: currency, oil, precious metals, stocks, bonds, or all of the above. And Swartz says most of them use borrowed money or leverage to juice their returns.
Now, a hedge fund is basically a catch-all term for any number of investment strategies that can invest in anything from bonds, stocks, the third race at Aqueduct.
The third race at Aqueduct. Yeah! Well, if a hedge fund manager did walk up to the betting window with a few million bucks, he'd be looking to place a bunch of bets, all at different odds. Washington University finance professor Charles Cooney explains the goal would be to spread the risk around the whole field of horses.
So they might bet on Candy Dandy to come in fourth, Lucky Tiger to come in sixth, and some other horse is going to break its leg.
By betting on a lot of different outcomes, the hedge fund can make money off the third race no matter how it finishes. And in theory, the same goes for any market, stocks, bonds, commodities, that a hedge fund might invest in. But hedging is no guarantee of success. In really crazy markets like we're living through right now, so many bets go wrong that the fund can be exposed to huge risks. The problem's amplified by all that leverage. Just a small movement in markets can induce big losses and force managers to sell off assets at any price. And we've seen a lot of that lately at the racetrack called Wall Street. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, great art comes at a great price.
To be in the presence of such a work, a tear comes to my eye every time.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so think of it this way. Wall Street only has a couple of down days left this year, doesn't it? The Dow Industrials paired off 31 points today, a third of 1%, to finish at 84.83. The Nasdaq rubbed off 19 points, 1.3%, ended at 1510. The S&P 500 shaved off 6.7%, closed at 866. Kuwait's scrapping of that joint venture with Dow Chemical was largely responsible for the lackluster day, but it didn't help that holiday retail sales are about the worst in 40 years. Jones Apparel disrobed 19% today. Liz Claiborne unzipped 12%. Chipmaker Micron Technology slid nearly 9% today. Analysts say the company drained down its cash reserves last quarter and is going to have to raise some more. Walt Disney shook off 3.2% of its pixie dust. Analysts say media companies face a bad year despite record-breaking movie sales during the Christmas season. The 10-year T-note gain, that pushed the yield down to 2.12%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. On December 30th, 1922, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was formed. Its economic policies were based on the theories of Karl Marx. The USSR was dissolved in 1991. And singer-songwriter Patti Smith turns 62. She'll be playing a show on her birthday in New York City. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. This was a pretty good year to be in business journalism. Brand new stories every day. Often on days of a big bailout or other investment bank going under, there were new stories a couple of different times every day. So we thought it might be interesting to go back over our coverage of the fallout from the economic crisis and check back in with some of the people we spoke with as the news was happening. We begin today with Mort MacArthur. He's a used car dealer, Mort's Imports, just outside Cincinnati. Our Amy Scott visited Mort while she was out on the road this fall, and at the time, things weren't looking so good for him. Mort, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you. Thank you for having me back.
I suppose the question ought to be, since you are back, how's business now as opposed to when we had you on a couple of months ago?
The business at the moment for this month is about the same. The 5 out of the last 6 months have been losers. 1 month was about break even. But I'm seeing more activity. I'm getting more emails. I'm getting more phone calls. It's just that people that have money have been reluctant to part with it, and people that don't have money have had a hard time securing loans.
I want to play a piece of tape from Amy Scott's piece in October, and then I'll come back and ask you about it.
It's going to eventually come back. All I need to do is just withstand.
You sound pretty optimistic for a guy who's been losing money 5 out of the last 6 months.
Well, I am, and truthfully, and I have been losing the money. I can show it to you both personally and in the business net worth. But the truth is, I honestly believe that the income tax season will bring some relief, and every car dealership that goes out of business is one less car dealership that I'm going to be in competition with when it does crank back up. So mine now really is to endure. As long as I can withstand the pressure of the downturn, when things do make a turnaround, I should be able to be free and clear for a little while.
Income tax season, you mean people get the refunds and they come out and buy a car from you?
Correct, yeah. When you sell for cash and don't do financing, a lot of people save that type of year to come when they've got a large check that they can go ahead and do that with, and then tie it with either money they can borrow from a relative or money that they've already got saved or from another lending institution.
What happens, Mort, if the next 6 months aren't real kind to you and the optimism that you have now is misplaced?
Well, I probably won't be here 6 months from now if it's that bad. I'm sort of looking as if things have not brightened by March, that I will probably start the process of shutting down and or taking the dealership itself into a different direction and maybe just going wholesale. These are not things that I really want to do, but they're things I got in the back of my head as a backup position rather than just closing the doors and having to go find employment for the last few graying years that I have left.
Mort MacArthur owns Mort's Imports. It's a used car dealership in Plainville, Ohio, just outside Cincinnati. We had him on our special Fallout series, The Road to Ruin, back in October. Amy Scott did a story on it. You can hear that at our website, marketplace.org. Mort, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you, Kai. I really appreciate it. Good luck on your end. I've got optimism on mine.
Thanks a bunch. We'll see you later.
Bye.
You know how if somebody lends you something and you hang on to it long enough, you kind of start to think of it as yours? Happens all the time with things like books and sweatshirts, right? And mostly, it's no big deal. But what happens when the objects in question are 450-year-old masterpieces by the Renaissance painter Titian? That's the situation the National Galleries of Scotland finds itself in. The paintings have been on loan to the galleries for decades. Now, though, the owner, a Scottish duke, wants to sell them. He's willing to charge the museum what he says is a bargain price, nearly $150 million. But his deadline is coming up fast. Christopher Worth reports the museums are scrambling to raise the cash.
This isn't the best time to try and scrape together $50 million. Just ask Carol Plazada, a curator here at the National Gallery in London.
We've never had to raise this much before, ever.
We would be London's National Gallery and the National Galleries in Scotland. They need the $50 million to buy Diana and Actaeon, a painting by the Italian Renaissance master Titian. Andrew MacDonald is deputy director of the Art Fund in London, which donated £1 million to the cause.
It is one of the supreme masterpieces by arguably the greatest painter in the Western tradition.
The painting has been on loan to Scotland for 60 years, but now its owner, the Duke of Sutherland, needs cash. So he's given the museums until December 31st to pay up, or he's selling to the highest bidder. And as an added incentive, the Duke will throw in a second Titian masterpiece for another £50 million. That's $75 million. And the museums don't have to pay that bill for a few more years. The paintings have been in Britain so long that the public can't imagine the UK without them.
They've kind of become part of the furniture, but of course they aren't actually owned by the public. That's the trouble.
People fall in love with these paintings, which might explain why they've changed hands just a few times over the last 450 years. Titian based them on Ovid's Metamorphoses. And just in case you're a little rusty on your Roman poetry, and I know I am, Plazzada explains.
The story is based on the hunter Actaeon, who inadvertently stumbles where no man should ever venture.
Titian captures the hunter as he innocently opens a curtain to reveal a half dozen bathing women, including the goddess Diana. The paintings ended up in Paris by the 18th century, where they stayed until, ironically, a financial crisis emerged. Most people would like to keep them here, but they realize that the middle of a financial crisis may not be the best time to convince public and private donors to part with £50 million. But Plazzada says it's worth the effort.
To be in the presence of such a work, a tear comes to my eye every time.
So the galleries have launched a celebrity-studded campaign to raise awareness and money. It includes Sex and the City's Kim Cattrall. She posed nude for a photographic recreation of the painting to get the Brits in a philanthropic mood.
We are cautiously optimistic.
But a change in the tax code might go a lot further than a naked TV star. Unlike the U.S., Britain doesn't offer good tax breaks to people who donate artworks while they're still alive.
Unless you're dead, it can't happen.
So art owners, like the Duke of Sutherland, he's the one peddling the Titians, must convince museums to buy them out. And the whole process has some Brits wondering how an Italian painting should be so important to their national heritage anyway. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go, shares of the Ford Motor Company dropped about 3% today. That's a development that can only cause billionaire investor Kirk Kerkorian to say, phew, got out of that one just in time. Kerkorian announced today he has finished selling off all his shares in what is arguably the healthiest of U.S. carmakers. Kerkorian, of course, is a serial investor in Detroit. At various times, he's had major stakes in GM and Chrysler, as well as Ford. His most recent effort, though, didn't turn out so well. He spent $1 billion earlier this year for a 6.5% stake in Ford. At today's closing price, he's out about $700 million of it. And we are out of here. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 31 points. That's a third of a percent. The NASDAQ lost 19 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 shook off 6 points, 0.7% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the broadcast, why the stock market has its own emergency break.
You know, a lot of trading the last few months have been on emotions instead of fundamentals. So when you get a circuit break, you stop those emotions, everybody catches their breath, and they can reorganize.
One can only hope. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.